Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here is 722-0839, and we are here with Tom Greer, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council. Tom will talk about Lyme's disease today. He was on our show once before, and by popular demand, which is probably not a great thing to say when it comes to Lyme's disease, but we have a lot of our listeners out there that are concerned about it, either for themselves or for a family member or someone that they know. And this is a very, very serious disease that's affecting our area up here.
Oh, it certainly can be. Yes, people have been disabled, and even worse, it's a life-stealing disease. People may not be completely disabled, but it has certainly affected the quality of their life.
Well, let's talk about how you got involved. And I know there's been listeners that have heard you on the show before, but for those of the people who out there that are hearing you for the first time, give us a little bit of your background and how you got so involved in this research.
Well, I was making a pretty good living. I was in the pharmaceutical industry, and my whole job was knowing science and a background with scientific papers and research and so on. And prior to that, I had done medical research. And I started having a series of symptoms that seemed disconnected from each other. I had numbness and tingling in my hands. I had shooting chest pains. I began to have visual disturbances, sensitivity to bright lights. Then I started having an enlarged heart, which everyone said, well, that's completely unconnected to, you know, your joint pain and your muscle pain that you're having. And then I started getting pressure in my head. And this was my worst symptom. And it's not a common symptom of Lyme, but it's one that I had. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Visually, my field diminished until my vision was about the size of a basketball in front of my head. My peripheral vision was pretty much gone. My heart was enlarged, and I had a condition called atrial fibrillation. I had already been diagnosed with a couple other conditions like Meniere syndrome, Wolff-Parkinson syndrome, and a couple other things. And all of this turned out to be not the case. All my symptoms were, in fact, connected. But every time I was sent to a cardiologist, they looked at cardiology problems. I would be going to ear, nose, and throat. They would look at ear, nose, and throat problems. I'd go to a neurologist. They'd look at neurology problems. And eventually, I was diagnosed with probable MS, a non-remitting, non-relapsing, rapid progressive form of MS. And I was actually told that I would end up in a nursing home, that there wasn't much choice for me. And during this time, my physician, I had collapsed, and I was brought to St. Luke's Hospital, and my physician was out of town. And a physician who had just come back from a Lyme disease conference the night before saw me the first thing Monday morning, and she looked at my chart and couldn't believe it. She said, I'm back for, 6 hours, and I'm finding my first Lyme patient. She says, you don't have MS. And even though there was no conclusive tests or anything, as soon as she started the medication, I started responding. I had massive muscle twitches and sweats and all kinds of indications that the antibiotic was doing something. But it took about 6 months before the pressure in my head went away and things started coming back. And just the ability to do things like drive a car, read a book, took about a year.
Well, now, for those of you out there, Tom graduated from the University of Minnesota Duluth in 77 with a double degree in biology and chemistry. And then you continued to work 2 years postgraduate work, clinical immunology at UMD Medical School, and then 1 year postgraduate work at the University of Washington in the Puget Sound doing research under a grant from NASA in geriatrics and the effects of nutrition on bone wasting. You had this background going into this, and so you had this knowledge. You were able to look at things in a different way than most people out there when they have different symptoms. But you also knew your body. You knew something was wrong.
Well, I definitely knew something was wrong, and I strongly felt that above and beyond anything else with my heart and arthritis and so on, that I had an infection in my brain, and I had no idea what it was. And what's interesting is when they told me it was Lyme disease, I really knew nothing about Lyme disease. It wasn't an area that I was familiar with. But as soon as they said it was a spirochete that caused the disease, all of a sudden, just everything made sense, because I had had, through medical school and graduate school, chances to work with people who had syphilis. And as soon as I heard spirochete, the first thing I thought is, this is like syphilis. Everything I have sounds like syphilis. And it was a terrible revelation at that point. And it also, I knew, there was a patient who had gone through Miller-Dewan Hospital about 1977, and he was on his third course of penicillin because his tertiary syphilis was not responding. This is syphilis that's in the brain. And they told me that if this didn't work, they were basically going to give up on him. There was no real cure. And I thought, this is curious. Well, this is the point that we reach with some of the Lyme patients. We now have very good evidence that the bacteria is getting into the brain. And like syphilis, is very difficult to treat once it's there.
Well, we have a caller here. Rick, good morning. Rick, are you there? Oh, I think we lost him. No? Are we here, Rick? Are you on the phone?
Wait, no, I'm waiting for Rick.
Oh, okay. Who is this here?
Frank Tarnowski.
Oh, Frank Tarnowski. Okay, and you have a question for Tom?
No, this is the personal one. I was supposed to call Rick a little after 10.
Oh, okay. You're calling a call-in radio show. We're going to just connect you with our producer, and he can maybe help you out here in just a second. We are visiting here with Tom Greer, and we're talking about Lyme's disease. Now this happened in 1973. Lyme disease was first discovered, but there's evidence, of course, that it didn't just start in 73. That's when they were able to identify it.
Well, in 1973, two housewives, Polly Murray and Judy Dench, were seeing so many cases of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis in the Connecticut area that they said, there's something wrong here. This can't all be juvenile arthritis, because there just isn't that much throughout the population. And when they sent a researcher out in 1975, he did relate this juvenile arthritis to the bite of a tick, but they didn't know what was causing the arthritis. So what they did was they named it Lyme arthritis, because they didn't know what it was called. And Lyme arthritis is no longer a term that's really used except as a symptom. Lyme disease is much, much more than just arthritis.
All right, let's talk about what happens from the moment that the tick, just kind of give us a breakdown so we can visualize what happens within the tick, and then also as it affects the human being.
All right. Inside the tick, it's a little different environment for the bacteria than it is in the human body. But an infected deer tick, usually in the spring, a nymph will be looking for a blood meal, and it'll attach to your skin. It senses body heat and carbon dioxide, and it will usually try to bite you in the first place it comes in contact with the skin. Once it bites you, it has to pull blood into its midgut and its stomach. And for whatever reason, the deer tick does something that most ticks don't do. It regurgitates that blood meal back into its host, and that's how you get infected. It regurgitates the blood right back into you, along with the bacteria. Now, along with Lyme disease, there may also be co-infections such as ehrlichiosis and babesiosis, and also other things that can be in the tick. Now, once it enters the bloodstream, it's circulating throughout your whole body. And this would be great if it just stayed in the bloodstream, because we can treat the bloodstream pretty effectively and pretty quickly. But it turns out that the Lyme bacteria doesn't like the blood, and it's very motile. It can swim just like a little screw-shaped worm. And it'll eventually attach to one of the blood vessel walls. Well, when it attaches to the blood vessel wall, it starts a process of inflammation, and that process of inflammation starts a cascade of digestive enzymes, starting with something called metallomatrix protease, tissue plasminogen, hyaluronidase, basement membrane laminase. But all these things work together to do one thing, to create a hole in your blood vessels. The bacteria then can swim through that blood vessel, and if that blood vessel happens to be in your knee, you might end up with a sore knee. If it's in your heart, it might end up in your heart. But if it's in the brain, it ends up in the brain, which is one of the places it wants to be. We've shown that this, in animal models, that it has a very definite tropism for certain organs and tissues, and the brain is one of the places it likes to get to. Now, once you punch holes in the blood vessels around the brain, other things can leak into the brain, such as albumin protein, bacteria, and white blood cells. And we don't like to have white blood cells in the brain because it can set up inflammation, and this is what I had. I had inflammation of the brain, encephalitis. And with this infection, once those blood vessels seal back up, you have the bacteria trapped in the brain, but you can't treat the brain very well because the drugs we use don't like to pass through that blood-brain barrier.
Well, we've got to take a commercial break right now. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton. We are visiting with Tom Greer, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council, and we're learning more about Lyme disease. Please stay tuned if you're interested in learning more about it for friends, family, or yourself. This is definitely an area that it affects this area in particular in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here is 722-0839, and we are visiting here with Tom Greer, the Executive Director for Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council. We're learning more about Lyme's disease. We have Harry on the line. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning. I have a question for Mr. Greer.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Greer, I had a dog that got Lyme disease about 3 years ago, and I took him to the vet. And he had he was very arthritic, and he had a leg that he dragged around.
Okay.
The vet looked at the dog and said, oh, he's got Lyme disease. And he treated him for about 9 weeks until he got well. And he treated him with some stuff called doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day. Well, I got Lyme disease last year, and I went to the doctor, and they treated me with 100 milligrams twice a day for only 3 weeks. And I didn't get well, so I went back to the doctor. And the doctor says, well, we'll give you 2 more weeks. So they gave me a total of 5 weeks of the doxycycline. And when I went back the second time, he said I had post-Lyme syndrome.
Okay.
My question is, treated the dog for 9 weeks. Why couldn't I get the treatment for more than 5 weeks?
Well, this has been one of the dilemmas since the very beginning of Lyme disease. In 1975, when Lyme disease was described, we didn't even know what caused Lyme disease, but they came out with a treatment protocol. They said since it responded to tetracycline, and we treat most tetracycline-type infections for 2 weeks, the protocol was to treat everybody with Lyme disease for 2 weeks with tetracycline. And then it moved on to doxycycline. And then we started seeing that we had many, many treatment failures in patients. And some doctors moved on to other medications or started treating longer. But ever since 1975, we've pretty much stuck with the same treatment protocol for humans, which is to treat for 2 weeks, even though at that time we didn't even know what caused Lyme disease. Now that we know that it is a slow-growing, slow-dividing bacteria that can hide and sequester in the body, there's no question that some patients need to be treated with longer duration. Now, veterinarians are very aggressive in some cases, and I've heard of dogs being treated for even longer periods of time. Basically, they're treating until all the symptoms are gone. And this is what we'd like to see in humans as well. I myself don't believe in post-Lyme symptom. I believe it's a recurrence of the bacteria that has perhaps been in sequestered places like joints or the brain. And this is why we urge patients to come to support groups and discuss with other patients what they've done. The question is if you still respond to antibiotics, then the antibiotics are doing some function that's helping the patient. But you have to work with the doctors and find a doctor who's willing to treat. Unfortunately, having been treated that first time, you've cleared the infection from the bloodstream, and now the antibodies that you would have normally been making are going to subside. And when they test you for Lyme disease, since the antibodies are no longer there in your blood, they're going to say you don't have it. But that's not the case. What you don't have is natural immunity. You don't have the antibodies. That doesn't mean you don't have active infection. So the sorry part of this is I can say, yes, you should probably be treated at least as well as your dog, but you have to get the medical community to go along with that.
Why is it the vets say all the dogs that come in have Lyme disease and the doctors are saying that there's only a couple of cases a year for humans?
Well, I don't have a real good answer for that. I there have been so many things that patients have been told. We were told here in St. Louis County that you can't get Lyme disease here because we don't have Lyme disease in this county. Well, that's not exactly the case. We don't have doctors that were reporting the disease to the Minnesota Health Department, but that doesn't mean we didn't have the cases. Certainly the veterinary cases were showing up right along. So we knew we had the bacteria here. In some cases, maybe they just find that complicated patients are not the kind of patients they want to treat, and it's easier to pass you along to the next person. It's very difficult right now for a doctor to get embroiled into a controversy, and there is a great controversy about the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease. And I hate to say that for patients, but it truly is. And so that's why patients have to seek out the consults of other patients sometime to find out what to do.
Thank you, Mr. Greer.
Thank you. And let's talk about that. Tomorrow night you actually have a support group. Let's get that out there for folks that want to learn more and actually be able to interact with other patients that are suffering from Lyme disease or have had Lyme disease and are concerned that they still may have it. 7 p.m. tomorrow night, it's a Duluth Lyme Disease Support Group meeting, and it'll be at St. Luke's Hospital on the third floor. And you're also going to speak there at this particular meeting, that's correct?
Yes, we have a Lyme support group meeting the first Tuesday of every month, but tomorrow night, in addition to the regular meeting, I'm going to be talking about how this bacteria gets into the brain, and I have some very good pathology slides and some case histories, including a local case history that I think people will want to see.
Well, we're going to take a hard news break right now. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. If you have questions for Tom, he is going to stick around. Number is 722-0839, toll-free 888-KDAL-610. All right, we are here visiting with Tom Greer. He is the director of Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council. And during the news break, we were talking about how people are coping with having Lyme disease and what can they do? I know you've got your meeting tomorrow night at 7, but what are some of the things that they can do?
Well, that's true. I would urge any Lyme patient or somebody who has previously been treated with Lyme but are still suffering from symptoms and depression, fatigue, and so on, to come to support groups and talk to other patients. But patients have been so frustrated because for 20 years, patients have been telling doctors that they were treated, they got a little bit better, they went off treatment, and they got sick again. Then the doctors say, well, we give you a Lyme test, you don't have it, we've already treated you, 2 weeks is enough. There used to be a 1-800 hotline that you called in Wisconsin, and it seemed like the whole purpose of this hotline was to tell every patient if you had 2 weeks of any antibiotic, you were cured. And they would just tell people this over the phone. But patients have become so frustrated that they have gone to extreme measures. And one of the things that we've done as a group is we formed a autopsy registry for patients. And these are patients who are saying, well, if I can't get an answer when I'm alive, when I die, I would like my body to go to research and we'll investigate these things. And I spent a week in Philadelphia with a neuropathologist working out the details for a pathology registry, tissue banking, and how to do these procedures. Now, the first patient who died was a patient in Ashland 7 years ago, and we had a brain autopsy done and performed by Dr. Alan McDonald. And what we found was exactly what new research is showing, that the spirochete bacteria that causes Lyme disease actually attached to the brain neurons, and they found it in almost every cross-section of the cerebral cortex of this patient, and they found neurons that were penetrated by the bacteria, which we were told cannot happen. They said that cannot go intracellular. Intracellular infections are harder to diagnose and harder to treat. Well, what we have here is a patient who had received treatment, was told there was nothing more they could do, He did not have Lyme disease, and when he died, in fact, his brain had active bacteria within the brain.
We've got a caller here right now. We'll take that call. Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Good morning. Thank you for the show. I heard about it, but, you know, this is real important information that's getting out. My two questions, I just heard him say that the regular wood ticks don't transmit because they don't regurgitate. Do you think that will hold, that they will not be transmitting it? And then the other thing is, I had read that the Army had a research facility on an island next to that Lyme, Connecticut. Do you think that has anything to do with it, that it was produced by the government, or has it always been in the ecosystem?
Thanks for your call, Greg. Do you know those answers to those questions?
Well, I can only give you what I think. We're finding every day that more and more ticks are carrying Lyme disease or first cousins of Lyme disease, such as in Europe, we find the sheep tick is the main carrier of Lyme disease, and that carries Borrelia burgdorferi, Abzelii, Grinii. We found now in southern Minnesota a dog tick called the Lone Star tick is carrying a form of Lyme disease, and this dog tick is transmitting it to humans. Now, up here, the most common tick we have is the Dermacenter dog tick, and it's not supposed to transmit the disease because the tick doesn't regurgitate its meals, but it is capable of transmitting other diseases, which makes me think, why not Lyme?
Right.
The other thing is that if you were to remove that tick improperly and you were to squeeze that tick while it was embedded, you very likely are going to squeeze bacteria right into your body. So you should never squeeze a tick when you're removing it from your body.
Let's talk about that real quick. What is the best way to remove a tick?
Well, there's been a lot of suggestions and such, but the main thing is you want to avoid squeezing the body. You want to pull it out head first if possible and get all the mouth parts out. The trouble with ticks is that when they insert their mouth parts, they actually glue them in place with a biological glue. And they can dissolve this glue very, very quickly, but when they don't want to come out, everyone's probably experienced, you got a piece of the tick still left in your skin, and you want to get that out if possible. There is a technique doctors can use to get ticks out where they just take a little bit of saline in an insulin syringe, and they make a bubble of saline under the tick bite, and the tick will start feeding on saline, and it doesn't like it, and it'll back right out.
What about, I know we used to put salt on leeches, and that just, they all just would dissipate. At one time I had like over 50 little tiny leeches on my foot. It was, I was a little kid. Lyme Disease Education Council, a local Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. Tom is a graduate of the University of Minnesota Duluth with a double degree in biology and chemistry, then continued his 2 years postgraduate work in clinical immunology. I can never say this one.
Immunology.
Yeah, at UMD Medical School. And then 1 year postgraduate work at the University of Washington and Puget Sound, doing research under a grant from NASA in geriatrics and the effects of nutrition on bone wasting. Doctors, you're there to educate doctors. And you said you've been doing this for 10 years, really trying to get on board with some of the facts that are out there actually about Lyme disease, and it's a difficult process.
I've been trying. The fact that I'm not a doctor is very difficult to get other physicians and such to listen to the whole story. So often is the case that I think doctors have what I call the CDC pamphlet education, which is this is the tick bite, this is the rash, this is the test for Lyme disease. If they test positive, you treat them for 2 weeks, but some are going to relapse, and it says that. Then at that point, many of them say, well, then it's out of my hands. I send them on to the infectious disease guy or somewhere else. But it has become sort of Lyme patients are like hot potatoes. You just kind of pass them along and not really do anything for them. You run more tests, you send them to different specialties, cardiology, neurology, and so on. But ultimately, the diagnosis and treatment is very simple. You treat with antibiotics until the symptoms are gone. When nothing else works and antibiotics are working, you've made the diagnosis clinically by seeing the response to the antibiotics. Unfortunately, in today's medical community with insurance companies and so on, they want a little box that says, does this patient have a positive test, yes or no? Does this patient already been treated, yes or no? Is doxycycline cheaper than IV Rocephin? Well, let's use that. You know, that's the state of medicine.
It's like a cookie cutter process.
Yes, it's very much a recipe for Lyme disease that's been used, unfortunately, for 20 years.
Well, let's talk about some of the dumb things doctors have told Lyme patients in the Lyme support group since 1984. I'll just give you it, and then you tell me if it's true or not.
We're going to make a lot of enemies here.
All right. So every Lyme patient gets a rash.
Absolutely not true. From the very, very beginning, going back to old Lyme, Connecticut, it was written that most patients, not all patients get the rash. Some say a third of them don't get the rash. Some say half of them don't get the rash. But it's absolutely clear that these patients don't always get a rash. Now, also, the rash goes away by itself. So if you were bitten and you had a rash on your back and you never saw it, well, then it might have gone away by itself, and you may have late-stage Lyme disease and never seen the rash. Or children play. They roll around in the grass and the bushes, and they get bit on the scalp, and that rash is under the hair. It's something you may never see. So to say that all patients get a rash is simply untrue in every sense.
Okay, here's the second one. A local physician told people on the radio that the Lyme rash has to be the size of a basketball or it's of no consequence.
Yes, I that's one of the recordings I treasure. That's simply not true. One of the misconceptions about the rash is that everyone gets the rash and that the rash is always a bullseye rash, that it clears in the center. Actually, most Lyme rashes do not have a perfect bullseye. They can be irregular shaped. They can be solid red. The one characteristic about them is that they are red and they tend to expand over a period of time over the skin, and they are not associated with any pain or bumps or blistering or anything.
Is there a bump ever in a Lyme disease? Could there be a bump?
Well, right where the tick bites you, you might get some inflammation and other co-infections and so on, a staph infection or whatever, and you may get a bump in the center where the tick bites you. But when the rash spreads out, what really that is the bacteria is in the skin, and everywhere the skin, the bacteria is, the inflammation is following it. And so the inflammation, the white blood cells and stuff, are causing the skin to turn red. And a good place to biopsy the skin for culturing the bacteria is right at the outer edge of one of these rashes, because that's where the bacteria is actually most recent.
All right, here's the third one. Dumb things doctors have told Lyme patients. All right, here we go. The same Lyme expert physician repeatedly tells doctors and patients that there has never been any documented cases of now you're going to have to help me out here, transplacental transfer of the Lyme from mother to fetus.
Yeah, actually one of the doctors that I met with years ago is a doctor that in 1989 released in a major peer-reviewed journal 8 autopsies done on fetuses that were miscarried by women who had Lyme disease. And right here, what we're looking at is one of the micrographs I got from Dr. Alan McDonald, showing in the brain of the fetus one of the spirochetes that had transferred from the mother into the fetus. Now, this same, and I have all these slides and can show them, this same case, it showed up in the spleen, the heart, the brain, and other places in the body. And so it's very, very clear that this is being transferred in some cases from a mother who gets infected to the fetus.
Well, this one we know is not true because we've already talked about it here. Patients over the phone have been told, you can't get Lyme here. We don't have Lyme disease in St. Louis County.
Well, you
they
know,
actually are still, are they still saying this? They're not still saying this, are they?
I hope not. I haven't talked to our county epidemiologist in a long time, and I'm sure he doesn't want to talk to me. But if you don't do the studies, you really don't have any evidence to refute. It was interesting. I gave a talk in Bemidji, what's the county over there, Beltrami? Anyway, and a physician stood up and said, we don't have any Lyme disease here. And he gave his little talk and such, and we don't have to worry about it, but we're prepared and so on. And then the very next thing is a veterinarian gets up and says, well, you know, I'm seeing like 17% of the dogs that are outside get Lyme disease, and we've documented it. They have positive tests, and we've cultured it and so on. And then the third person that got up said, well, you know, we have a difficulty getting patient doctors in this area to report the disease. And if you don't report it, then it appears on a map that there's no Lyme disease here. But in fact, there is Lyme disease here. And so that very first doctor felt pretty small by the third speaker in.
All right. We just have about a minute or so to talk about this one. A doctor in Webster, Wisconsin wrote a newspaper article stating, I was bit by a tick and got a rash and treated it within one day, and I never had any lingering symptoms. In fact, I had no other symptoms at all. There is no such thing as chronic Lyme disease.
Yeah, he was quite outspoken about patients being malingerers, and that they're really just getting their information on the internet and they want to be sick and so on. The fact is, if we were all physicians and we had access to diagnosis and immediate treatment, probably none of us would go on to have long-term symptoms. But when a patient goes to a doctor and they say, oh, there's nothing I can do, and then it takes them 6 weeks to see another doctor and he says there's nothing I can do, by the time they get to the last doctor who treats them, they may be a year into their infection before they're properly treated.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take a break right now. We've got a market watch we're going to get out there. The market is falling ever so sharply. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. The number here is 722-0839. Toll free 888-KDAL-610. And we are speaking with Tom Greer, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council, educating doctors and patients about Lyme disease. Hi, this is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. And the meeting tomorrow night, Tuesday, March 3rd, Duluth Lyme Disease Support Group meeting. And Tom Greer will be speaking at this meeting. It's at St. Luke's Hospital on the third floor, the East Clinic Conference Room, 7 p.m. And we are here visiting with Tom Greer. He's the Executive Director for the Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council, a local Minnesota nonprofit to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme disease. Tom, looking at all of this, these different types of things, now we say dumb things doctors have told Lyme disease patients. Now, we know that there are some good doctors out there well that have worked real hard in this. But how is your relationship with the doctors that are out there?
Well, truthfully, most physicians have not really contacted me or used our group as a source of information. They want to get their information from the Minnesota Health Department, the CDC. And unfortunately, I'm in direct conflict with two big organizations, the Yale Medical Community and the Infectious Disease Society of America, which has guidelines for diagnosing and treating Lyme disease that I just think are harmful to patients and ridiculous. And patients come out. In fact, right now there's a big protest going on at the Capitol. It's called the NatCap Lyme meeting, where the new Infectious Disease Society are drawing up their new council members. And there's great objections to what they're doing. And so patients are actually flying out to the East Coast right now to protest.
So this is actually something that really the folks that have Lyme disease, the people who have been affected because of family members that have Lyme disease, they're starting to say, hey, enough's enough. You can tell us one thing, but common sense, which the show is about, says, hey, if I'm not getting any better, then maybe this isn't really working.
Well, absolutely. And I knew something was wrong when I was misdiagnosed and so on. And I wrote a booklet in 1995, and that booklet went all the way around the world. Every country that has Lyme disease has the exact same stories, whether it's Canada, Finland, Romania, Russia. I've gotten calls from Japan, from probably 20 different countries. And all of them relate the same story. I was bit, I was treated, I got better, and then I relapsed. And when I relapsed, nobody would do anything for me. And this is the common story all over the world. And it doesn't matter if you're in Japan or China or Australia, New Zealand. All of these places have experienced some form of patient mistreatment for Lyme disease.
So why is it that, for example, you talked about Yale, and this is a distinguished university. I'm guessing very, very, I mean, they're smart people out there. What is it that, why is it that they're just reluctant to hear all of these stories?
Well, the first researcher that was really sent out to investigate in old Lyme, Connecticut was Dr. Alan Speer, and he's associated with Yale Medical. And Yale put together what they actually call, this is their term, the Yale Dream Team of Lyme Disease. And
they use the word dream team?
They use the word dream
okay.
team.
Okay. Are they going to the Olympics or what?
And they put together their own basis for this. Well, I think they chose the wrong things to build their foundation on early on. And rather than say, we are wrong or the patients are right or we have to reach a compromise, they just got tougher and tougher and tougher and insisting. And I think because they had the power and the prestige, all they had to say is, well, we're Yale, we're right, and everyone else is wrong. Mm-hmm. These patients think they're sick, but they're not really sick. And the patients are fighting back. They're saying, no. I mean, this autopsy registry we have, that, the purpose of that is because if they can't fight in life, they're going to keep fighting when they're dead. And the autopsies are coming back. What's going to win the battle for Lyme patients is good science, pathology, microbiology, and doing the studies. We haven't done the good pathology studies that need to be done.
Well, and also the fact that they're willing to fight back, and their family members and their friends are saying, we need to do something about this.
Oh, absolutely.
Because many things are political, and we talk about politics on our show, and if we don't get the people in those positions, the leadership, to recognize the importance of this, then it just continues on for hundreds of years, just like it did before we had a name for it. Here's another one, comment that was made. A local clinic told nearly all patients that unless you get a swollen knee, you can't have Lyme disease because all Lyme patients get a swollen knee.
Yes, for some reason, young doctors in medical school here were told that all Lyme patients get swollen knees. And for a while, about 10 years ago, every Lyme patient that we were getting to support group were saying, well, I'm supposed to have a swollen knee, you know, and so I don't have Lyme disease. And I go, that's ridiculous. It's a multi-system disease. It can affect the bladder, it can affect the brain, it can affect the heart, the eyes. Why just the knee? That makes no sense at all.
All right, we've got to take our news right now. We're visiting with Tom Greer. He's Executive Director of Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council, educating doctors and patients on Lyme disease. This is Common Sense with Corinda Horton on 610 KDAL. We have Sally on the air. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. You have a question or comment for Tom?
Yes. On more than one occasion, I have read that the bacteria that causes Lyme disease has been found in semen. My question to Tom is, does he have any knowledge of research currently being done or research that has been done on the in the past on the possibility that this could be sexually transmitted?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't know of any published studies that are actually based on research that have suggested that it's transmitted sexually. And everybody makes the assumption because it's a bacteria that's similar to syphilis, looks like syphilis, under the microscope, it's almost indistinguishable from the syphilis spirochete, that it must be sexually transmitted. But we don't know that. In fact, if it is, it's certainly not at the rate or provability that you can see in syphilis. Now, there have been anecdotal accounts saying, well, you know, my husband got sick, I didn't have it, and then years later I slowly got sick, and so on. And it's hard to put perspective on that and say, well, you know, that's what it is, because that's a correlation. It's not really proof of what it is. Now, there have been abstracts presented at conferences showing that the bacteria has been found in semen on occasion, but whether or not it's active and able to penetrate into another person, we don't know. There's all kinds of factors, you know, pH, motility, whether it's covered with antibodies, and the numbers of bacteria. The numbers of bacteria in Lyme disease are very, very small. So my feeling is if the numbers of bacteria were higher, it probably would be transmitted sexually. But at this point, we play it on the safe side and we say, well, probably not.
Well, and people, it can be cured from this. This isn't something that, is it forever in your body system? How does this work?
Most patients that get infected are treated and they never have to be treated again. And that's most of the patients. It's the patients that fall through the cracks that I see. And these patients are more difficult to treat. Maybe they weren't treated right away. Maybe it was a year, or maybe they have other circumstances like a genetic factor or something. But most patients, if they're treated early, and the earlier you treat, the more likely you are to be cured.
Well, we have a caller here. He's the critic, which he spelled it like with a tick at the end. But, the critic calls our show. He's one of our regular callers. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. And good morning to you and your guests. I was I was at a birthday barbecue last year, and someone that acquaintance of mine that came to the party, he went on and told me about all the stuff that he went through with this Lyme's disease, that he had to go all the way to Colorado before he got diagnosed.
Yes.
And it was a real, I mean, it was the stuff that he was telling me was unbelievable. But the one question that I had, and I do have a comment, but the one question I had was, do you know where this came from and the history of this Lyme's disease?
Well, that is a tough one. We don't really know where it came from. A lot of suggestions have been, well, we have much more diversity in Europe with the three different genospecies. So maybe it came over on rats and mice on the ships during the colonization of the New World. We don't know for sure. We do know we have museum mice in America that go back to 1894 that we know had the infection then. My feeling is it's probably been around an awful long time, because it when you look at the evolution of this bacteria, it seems to have so many cases where it's able to interact with mammal systems where it had to evolve to do those things. How it was able to get into the bloodstream, penetrate through blood vessels, have a tropism for certain tissues. Those things don't just happen overnight. Those things evolve. And so I think this has been around in nature for an awful long time. Where it originally came from, I can't say. I mean, that debate is still going on about syphilis as well. So I just don't know.
And then you had a comment as well?
Well, from what I understand is the very first reported case of Lyme's disease in the United States was across the river from one of these bio labs.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit in our first hour. It's actually from Connecticut. That's where they came up with the name of it. And what Tom is saying is that it's probably been in long before that.
Well, isn't it funny that these bio labs that work on just some of the most dangerous stuff on our planet are located by very high populated areas?
Well, to that end too, you know that they tried to rebuild a Plum Island like facility in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin was actually lobbying for this, and as I understand it, it got passed over. So luckily we're not going to have that in our backyard. I don't know what to think about the Plum Island facility and such, but a lot of people suggest that the Lyme infection increased exponentially when Plum Island appeared, and so they must have played a role. I don't know. Here's what I deal with. I have science articles and studies and things that I know are true and tangible, and that's what I try to pass on to patients and doctors. Now, as far as the Plum Island conspiracy, it's nice information to look at, but I don't know, and I can't do anything about it.
No, but it's just, to me, it's just, I was listening to another radio program a while back, and he brought up the fact that these bio labs that are, like I said, dealing in the most dangerous stuffs on the planet are located in high populated areas.
That's definitely something to look
at. The Plum Island was the one I was talking about. And thank you very much.
Oh,
I'll I'll listen to the rest on the radio.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, we're going to go back to our list of top 10.
I did have a quick comment.
Sure.
You mentioned that patients are going out to Colorado. The reason they're going to Colorado Springs is a physician there, Dr. Martz, was diagnosed with ALS, and he was completely disabled, a great physician. And it turned out to be Lyme. He got properly treated, and he came out of retirement just to treat other Lyme patients. And because he knew and was able to understand Lyme patients and could ask the right questions and do the right treatments, hundreds and thousands even of patients flocked to him. Now, he's, you know, in his 80s, he had to retire again. But he came out of retirement just to treat patients, and because nobody else was doing it.
And why is it that doctors do not want to, you know, if here's a guy who's being successful, patients are flocking to him, and he has information to pass on before he leaves this earth.
Yes.
And why is it that there isn't more doctors that are gravitating to his information and his research and the fact that he had a life experience that helped to understand it better? Why are they, is it just because there's just so many different things out there that doctors have to be concerned with?
I think a lot of doctors are really caught up in the medical business. They have to see as many patients as they can. They don't want to rock the boat. They want to get home at night. The administration calls the shots and says, well, we don't want you to see 5 patients. We want you to see 55 patients, and Lyme patients take up too much time. I mean, there's 1,000 reasons I could give. But it's up to each individual doctor to, you know, tell us why. And the reason I say that is because a handful of doctors have gotten serious Lyme, and Dr. Leslie Fine was disabled out east and became quite an advocate. We have a doctor here in Minnesota who's been affected by Lyme disease and has not been able to practice for 3 years and has been an outspoken advocate.
But we have a caller here. Jeannie, good morning. You're on Common Sense with Corinda Horton. You have a question or comment for Tom Greer?
I sure do. Wonderful program. Doctor, my daughter lives in Elk River, and she'll be 37, and she was having some symptoms, and they ruled out MS by the process of elimination, diagnosed her with fibromyalgia. She's on various medications for muscle aches and different things, and I'm wondering, does Lyme disease mimic some of this stuff too?
Well, they used to call syphilis the great imitator, and now they call Lyme disease the great imitator, because it can affect any system in the body, so it can affect the eyes, the heart, and so on. But in many cases, it replicates the symptoms of rheumatological diseases such as arthritis, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, ALS, Parkinson's disease. All of these things have been misdiagnosed. We see in every support group across the country at least a couple patients that had been diagnosed with MS that made good recoveries because what they really had was Lyme disease. And our group, MIBDEC, we actually did a study here in Pine County and looked at patients that had multiple sclerosis and came up with the conclusion that some of them are being misdiagnosed. So it's very possible that she does have Lyme disease, but the real key is, does she respond to antibiotics? If she goes on antibiotics and she starts to get better, then you have to make a bargain with your doctor and say, hey, let's go with what works. Now, a lot of people say, well, antibiotics are dangerous drugs and so on, but you have to realize it wasn't that long ago that doctors were treating kids with acne for 10 years with tetracycline and doxycycline and so on, and thought nothing of it. Now we have an infection of the heart and the brain, and they're telling us they can't treat longer than 2 weeks. There's something wrong there.
Yeah, and you know what? And she has like dry eye and all these kinds of things, you know, that have been affected. So I think I'm going to call her and ask her to talk to her doctor about Lyme disease.
Yes, and she can certainly contact a local support group, too, and we'd be more than glad to have her.
Well, she lives in Elk River, and so that's a smaller community with not all the resources, but I will pass.
Oh, I've got many relatives in Elk River.
Yeah, it's a wonderful community.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for your call. You know, we're talking here with Tom Greer. He's the executive director of the Minnesota Insect-Borne Disease Education Council, a local Minnesota nonprofit organization to help educate doctors and patients about Lyme's disease. And then one of the other fallacies here, it says, a Wisconsin 1-800-Lyme hotline repeatedly told patients that 2 weeks of any antibiotic especially IV, here's another fancy word, would cure all Lyme.
Yeah, intravenous antibiotics. It's interesting. There seems to be a lot of faith in intravenous antibiotics, that they are the way to go and that they're going to treat this disease. And if you have 2 weeks of that, you really don't have to have anything else. Well, that's what doctors believed in Nantucket Island. And what they did, though, was epidemiologists went to Nantucket, looked at 160 patients that were, for 5 years, those patients that were treated with 2 weeks with IV intravenous antibiotic did the worst. Mm. The ones that got 6 months of amoxicillin did the best. Oh. It was length of treatment.
Right, length of treatment. We've got Karen. Karen, we've just got about a couple minutes before we have to go to the market watch. Karen, you have a question or comment for Tom?
I do. My daughter is experiencing a lot of these rheumatological symptoms. She's also allergic to wheat. She went on a wheat sugar kind of fast and improved a little bit, went off of it, and got back. Is there some relationship with sugar maybe and yeast and that with the spirochetes?
Well, there's nothing that is definite that we can prove, but it, like I say, if patients are doing something and it's working, you want to stick with it. There can be all kinds of different allergies that are affecting a patient and their immune system and so on, but you do have to be careful too, is when you're chronically ill, there's a lot of people that want to take advantage of you with dubious cures, and but the one thing I would say is if patients are experiencing relief from something that they're doing, stick with it. But I don't see any relationship between sugar and diet and Lyme disease.
Okay.
Thank you for your call. We've got to take our get our market watch in here. This is Common Sense with Corinna Horton on 610 KDAL. Number here is 722-0839.